Hollywood is rated LGBT radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good day, good afternoon, good evening, good morning, whenever you happen to be listening to our podcast, you're welcome. This is Rated LGBT Radio, and I am your host, Rob Watson. Today we are returning to a topic that we have discussed before. It's an extremely important one. That is the topic of quote-unquote, major air quotes, conversion therapy, reparative therapy, any supposed pseudoscience therapy program in the United States that purports to change one's sexual orientation. It is a therapy or a practice that is done oftentimes under religious banners. And so there is different controversy on the part of conservatives that this is a freedom of religion issue. Invariably, it victimizes teens and people who are under 18 who are thrust into these programs without really their consent. Usually somebody who has either been suspected of being gay or has come out, and their families throw them into it. To date, 20 states and almost 70 municipalities in the U.S. have passed laws to protect LGBTQ youth from such therapies. Today, we are going to talk to Matthew Shurka, who is the co-founder of Born Perfect. And Born Perfect is an organization that has amassed a legal team that is working to fight these therapies across the country. I know for me personally, I got involved in this years ago before any states had passed legislation against it, and California being the first to do so. And I was writing articles for Huffington Post when the bill was in process in the state legislature, coming out as a gay dad, very much in favor of this bill passing, and even got into a little online debate with the head of the California Psychiatric Association. That association originally came out against it and then reversed and came out for it, which was a good move, and that passed, and California was the first in the nation to do so. Matthew obviously has had a lot of firsthand knowledge of this, having been put into such a program when he was young. And we're going to get to him about what kind of horrors he endured as a part of that and what motivated him to carry this forward as a cause to go up against. But before we bring Matthew on, I do want to welcome on my beloved co-host, the esteemed journalist, Brody Levesque. Brody, welcome to the show.
Hey, good afternoon, Rob. Good afternoon to our listeners, wherever you may be, or good evening, as the case may be. Today has been another rough day as the global pandemic continues to rage, particularly here in the United States. Governor Gavin Newsom, in his daily press conference in California, announced that there were 115 deaths in the previous 24 hours, which is a significant increase for the state of California. Earlier today in his press conference, Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York announced that the results of a serological blood test in 19 counties of the state of New York, over 40 different centers and 3,000 people, showed that at least 21% of the population of the state of New York, which includes New York City, has actually been exposed to the COVID virus. Now, these tests are reliant on antibodies, which means that you've had the virus and you've passed through it. New York has experienced a little bit of a leveling off in deaths. However, they're still averaging about roughly 300 to 400 a day. We'll get the final numbers in. At one point, it was as high as almost 1,000 deaths a day. As of yesterday, across the United States, there have been 856,209 cases, with 47,272 Americans who have lost their lives to the COVID virus. President Trump has assured the nation that they will be stepping up efforts to get more testing supplies out to the states that are in critical need of it. While that's going on, there's ongoing controversy over some states' governors, including Brian Kemp of Georgia, making decisions to early open the state from the restrictions of the stay-at-home orders, which have now been enacted in all 50 states, which has created quite a bit of controversy, even generating a comment from President Trump in yesterday's briefing that he did not agree with that decision. It looks, based on numbers, according to what Dr. Fauci and the other experts at the CDC and NIH are telling those of us in the press corps, that stay at home is in fact working, that limiting contact to others is essential to beating this virus down. The other, of course, part of the problem is that this is only wave one. Most of the experts, including the head of the CDC, are saying that we need to buckle up because this fall, during the beginning of flu season, could actually be worse. In conversations with the CDC earlier today, I was told that we're looking at still 14 to 18 months out on a possible vaccine, although there is two laboratories working on this, one in Germany and the other in France, that are further developing what could potentially be a vaccine in a much shorter period of time. But even they are optimistically saying maybe 12 months at the outset of that. In LGBTQ news, Rob, the thing that's kind of got everybody struck today was an announcement by the Conservative Equalities Minister in the United Kingdom. And the Tory minister had made the announcement that she's going to, as part of doing what they call the Gender Recognition Act, disallow juveniles from transitioning. And her comment directly, her name is Liz Truss, Minister Truss said, finally, which is not a direct issue concerning the Gender Recognition Act, but is relevant, making sure that the other 18s are protected from decisions that they could make that are irreversible in the future. This is an argument that we have seen repeatedly, particularly from the what we call TERFs, or the Trans-Exclusionary Radical Feminist groups, and other groups who are opposed to transgender rights, not only just in the United Kingdom, but of course in the United States and across the globe. Having a Tory minister make that kind of declaration is not unsurprising, but at the same time is a setback, and it also puts trans youth in the United Kingdom at risk. And that's
Brody,
good for a news summary.
Yeah, Brody, when you say that the Tory has put a prohibition on transitioning, what part of transitioning does that cover? Does that cover them dressing, taking on their real identity, or is it physical, medical transitioning? What are they trying to make illegal?
Essentially, what would be happening in this particular case, what the Tory minister is suggesting, would be medical in nature. And the problem is it would remove access to, provable treatment for anyone suffering from gender dysphoria, which is its medical terminology. This means blocking access to cross-sex hormones, puberty blockers, things of that nature. The other part of it is that it would kind of limit the ability of the National Health Service, which is the countrywide health care provider in the United Kingdom. Their providers would not be allowed to work with these kids in that venue. And now there's questions as to whether or not that would also include healthcare in terms of psychological needs and other needs. There hasn't been any move in terms of what we call presentation, which is actually in many ways a completely separate issue when you get into the political venue from this. There seems to be kind of a set aside when it comes to that. So presentation isn't targeted quite as heavily as the medical aspects to this. And of course, the medical aspects are in fact very much a crucial part to the entire, you know, viewpoint for a trans kid.
Right. Well, especially since a lot of the hormone blockers actually prevent them from having bodily changes. I mean, it's sort of the opposite of what that ruling says. In other words, it delays things so that they do have time to reflect and know themselves before their body starts physically making theoretically some decisions for them. What is the role of the Tory for those of us Americans who are not familiar with the British system? Is that the equivalent of a judge? I mean, how pervasive is this ruling?
Well, it's Tory is a descriptive term for what would be the English version of the Republican Party. A Tory is a conservative. And this minister is part of Boris Johnson's cabinet. She answers directly to the prime minister. Britain has been undergoing a considerable back and forth on this Gender Recognition Act, which has been under consideration by Parliament. And her job is implementation of the act and recommendations on the act. So essentially, she's holding a position. I guess the closest American equivalent would be to a cabinet level secretary of a department. So it's when I say Tory, I'm using the political vernacular for a conservative in a particular party. In this case, the party in power in the United Kingdom, which of course is the Tory Party, the Conservatives, as opposed to Labour. The Labour's party roughly equating to the Democrats to a point.
So this could be legislatively changed by them if powers that be in the UK want to fight it?
If they could get the Prime Minister and they could get others to back this in a parliamentary way, then there would be a way of reversing this particular thing. But, you know, the Gender Recognition Act and the reforms that are being posted with this, and this kind of, in a way, also plays into what our guest will be talking about, and that's the whole revolving argument around a person's sexual orientation or gender identity. Which in the United Kingdom generally is different than it's handled here in the States. But, you know, looking at it realistically, this is kind of the same type of attitude that we've seen in the problems here in the U.S. And the thing about this particular issue and why it's extremely relevant to the U.S. Is because a lot of the TERFs and people that are very much opposed to a Gender Recognition Act and are vehemently opposed to gender affirmation by minors are being directly funded by conservatives and the evangelical crowd here in the United States, including the Alliance Defending Freedom, the Heritage Foundation, and other conservative groups here in the U.S., so, and TERF organizations as well. So, you know, all things considered, this is, you know, part and parcel of the American organizations exporting, you know, their peculiar brand of pseudoscience and ugliness overseas, in this case to the UK.
Right. Well, yeah, it's the anti-side. I mean, there's a thematic through line between what we're going to talk about today in terms of conversion therapy and what they're purporting to do, which is to stand up for the rights of teens who cannot stand up for their own rights. And theirs, unfortunately, I think is very ill-founded and creates the same sort of harm that we're talking about with conversion therapy, because it leads the teens to mental illness, suicide, and and basically a very miserable teen existence. With that, let's bring on our guest. Our guest is Matthew Shurka, and Matthew is the co-founder of Born Perfect.
Yes.
Matthew, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We're pleased to have you on. Our pleasure. So, Matthew, take us back to your own history as a teen yourself and the coming out process and how you yourself ended up in one of these conversion therapy programs.
Yeah. I grew up in the suburbs of New York City, which some people may find surprising just because New York is such a liberal center. But I grew up 30 minutes from Manhattan. And despite all that, my parents were naive and had a conservative perspective on what it meant to be gay. And when I came out to my father at 16 years old, he told me how much he loved me and was really supportive in that moment. And it was the following day that my father had this panic of what it meant that his only son could be gay and live a gay life. And he began getting opinions from different therapists here in the New York City area. And so in his search, he met a licensed professional who explained that there is no such thing as homosexuality, that anything LGBTQ stems from childhood traumas. And because I was only 16 years old and I was younger and less experienced sexually, that I would have the highest probability of overcoming my same-sex attraction. And my father came home, and this was music to his ears. For my father, this
right.
meant that there was an opportunity that I could still end up straight and that I should be, you know, he's going to pay for it, of course. Maybe not, of course, but as a teenager, my dad was going to do it, whatever he could for me to live a straight life. And so I began conversion therapy in Manhattan at the age of 16, and this is only 2004.
And one of the things they did in this therapy was they instructed you to stay away from your mom and your two sisters. On what basis did they propose that to you, and how did that play out?
We have licensed professionals who are doing conversion therapy, and then there's unlicensed, like a pastor or a life coach that is claiming they can do this work. And so in my situation, they explained that in this theory that something in my childhood had caused this, and it can be something as subtle as, you know, a distant father and you're too close to your mother or an overbearing mother, or the other extreme of the range of things that could have happened in my childhood. Maybe I was molested or raped as a kid. But somewhere in this range of things, it caused my homosexuality. Lucky for me, I had a great upbringing. I think my parents did a pretty good job. There was nothing really that stood out as trauma. And so they immediately categorized me as, you know, too close to my mom and my sisters. I'm the youngest of three, and I have two older sisters. And my father worked a lot, and I was distant from him, but nevertheless, we had a good relationship. And so the immediate instructions were, I'm going to spend as much time with the boys as possible, whether in the male figures like father, uncle, or my peers at school. And I know there's a lot of irony in that, but the reason they told me that was they wanted me to understand my masculinity and that men are my peers and not women or girls or are not my peers. You know, basically telling me don't be that high school kid with all the girlfriends. And what they really wanted me to understand was, one, make sure I see women or girls as my opposites and not to pick up any effeminate behavior. And as you just said, the instructions were not to speak to my mom and sisters. And I actually wasn't allowed to speak to them that lasted 3 years.
Oh my God.
I think it just opens up a little bit of how conversion therapy really began and lasting to this day. I'm a 31-year-old man today. But the impact that had on all of us as a family, was tremendous.
That's horrible, and even that has some lasting ramifications, I'm sure. I mean, it's on so many levels. I mean, one, just on terms of the concept with your parents, being a parent myself, you know, parents, we always worry that something we're doing is going to have an adverse effect on our child, and to get blamed for something that we think is going to make our child's life harder is a burden in itself.
Yeah.
Matthew, what did you, from that experience, what scars, emotional, mental scars, do you feel like you've carried forward from having been through that?
I think the hardest, more than anything right now, it's funny to look at it like that. Just, you know, I think I'm in such an amazing place in my life, and I've grown and learned so much. But the thing that like sticks with me is there's always a little bit of distrust. And you know, I have a great relationship with my mother and my father today, and I've overcome so many obstacles. You know, I did contemplate suicide. I was in conversion therapy for 5 years from age 16 to 21. I was estranged from my family for years. You know, there were so many things that I had to go through. So, and even though we've rebuilt our relationships and I have a great relationship, there's so many moments where I catch myself not trusting people, their opinions or their their thoughts or some behaviors or actions. And I am reminding myself to trust them, and they, you know, and that love is there, and that I am their son, and we have grown as a family. The other thing I would say that probably lingers even more with me, just as an individual, you know, I am ambitious and I'm career driven and I want to do great things in my life. And it's just, I still have these moments where I look at myself, and I think a lot of LGBT people think about this, whether there was conversion therapy or not, but the amount of time that I spent trying to fix myself or other people fixing me, and then going through the pain of it and then overcoming it. We're talking about a decade to 15 years of my life to get to exactly where I was when I was 16, when I first started, which is I have a bright future ahead of me.
Here I am.
Here I am.
I'm anxious to get started. Yeah. So yeah, no, it's, I worry about that for anybody having been through that process, because I think those of us who were lucky enough to not, we can be a little bit cavalier about it. It's like, oh, great, you got through it. What didn't kill you makes you stronger, you know, boom, boom, boom. But I've had experience with people. The author Preston Grant, I became friends with, he wrote a book about sort of a tell-all about what it is to be gay from a historical, emotional perspective. But he also had been through kind of a horrific conversion therapy as a youth. And those demons plagued him even after being such a strong advocate and doing all that things. And just a few years ago, he took his own life. And it was, again,
wow,
the darkness that he just could not shake from having been put through that. And his was much more one of the religious perspective, quote unquote, conversion therapy that did that to him. Are those ramifications of mental health part of the legal cases that you and your team have been successful with?
Oh, of course. You know, ending conversion therapy has become the fastest and strongest movement or cause within the LGBT movement. We passed our first piece of legislation in 2012, and since that first legislation, which was in California, as you said earlier, 20 states and over 70 cities have all passed similar legislation to outlaw conversion therapy. And one of the factors, there's several factors that had the momentum grow so quickly, but one of them is the urgency of the impact on youth, whether it's mental health and suicidality, and how it is hurting specifically families. And that has really moved legislators and people in general who have not realized how prevalent conversion therapy is to start taking action on the issue.
Yeah, it's one of the aspects of it that has always bothered me a lot, and I've written on this, and it's not often discussed, but a lot of the people who are the heads or who are position themselves as quote-unquote therapists or experts in this reparative therapy, conversion therapy process are oftentimes men who claim to have overcome their own same-sex attraction. In other words, you know,
yes.
I've been healed of this, therefore I am going to carry this forward. Most of us who are gay and have come to terms with it and know the struggles of repression and denial and then self-acceptance, pretty much are aware that it never goes away. So what gets set up with these so-called counselors is you have somebody who is not truly healed, they're just repressed, and then they get into situations with young men and a lot of actual sexual abuse ends up happening under the umbrella that this person is trying to heal the younger person of their homosexuality. What has your experience been in encountering that kind of situation?
Yeah, it's a vicious cycle. It's real and it exists. Yes, you know, we see religious figures who are promoting conversion therapy. There are some therapists who purely are making profit from this so-called technique. And then there's those that you just said, gay men who said that they've cured their own homosexuality are now ex-gay. And, you know, it's just... It's a vicious cycle. I think these men never made peace. I believe our laws are stopping these practices, and they're being accountable for. But those people need just as much support as those youth, which I think is terribly sad. The good news I can add is we are seeing those therapists specifically. The ones that say they've cured themselves are coming out of the closet, one, denouncing conversion therapy, and two, coming out of the closet as gay, lesbian, or trans individuals. And that's
right. A
really telling sign. You know, and it's been happening as these laws have been passing. You know, Exodus came down. Oh my God, his name is slipping my name. The last president of Exodus came out as a gay man, and Exodus ran the largest, I don't know what the right word is, ring or community or conversion therapy programs in the country. And for him to publicly state that not is he only shutting down the doors, but also is a gay man. And every year we have very notable conversion therapists shock the communities they are serving. And they're not just religious figures. They are licensed practitioners. And so I think I'm answering the question. I just wanted to acknowledge how terrible it is. It's basically those people. You know what it comes down to? I think I spend a lot of time thinking about this and I work on it directly. You know, there's nothing more painful, and this goes for all LGBTQ people, there's nothing more painful than losing the community you're from. And being LGBTQ threatens that existence. And seeing it time and time again, especially with adults who have lived openly gay lives and then choose to do conversion therapy as an adult, they never were able to maintain a strong community or ground their community, whether it was within the LGBT community or losing their family at home. And there's this reoccurring theme that I see in all of my observations, wanting to feel connected. And conversion therapy, in some, I know it sounds so weird, but it's a place where they develop a community, but they never actually cure anything or heal anything.
Right.
You know, and yeah, and that, and I can go into those details of what a vicious cycle that is, where really people should be taught and given the opportunity to love themselves as they are and be accepted in a community.
No, that's a really good point, and I've heard that. I mean, because it's there's a camaraderie, albeit dysfunctional, that kind of occurs there, you know, and it's both sad, frustrating, and difficult. I've seen things like where they've had these trying to pull like a march on Washington, where you know they were going to have an ex-gay day, and you know they were going to have tons of people, and then like five people show up, and the conservative radio hosts and all that who are behind it come out and say, well, it's because my ex-gay friends, it's because of those radical homosexuals that will abuse them and attack them and everything else. And I read between the lines on that and going, you know what? I have a feeling your ex-gay friends are not as ex-gay as you think. And by showing up there and being public, they're going to get recognized by people that go, oh yeah, that's the guy I did last week, you know? You know, so it just, you know, it's a little ironic, but Matthew, tell us about so you got through that process. What was the end of it? How did you kindly call it and say, no, this isn't working, this isn't right, and how did that lead you to the development of Born Perfect?
Yeah. It really makes a difference, the fact that I was 16 when I started conversion therapy. I really was lost in knowing who to trust. Was it my family? Was it the licensed professional who was treating me? I think it would have been a different case if I was 18. You know, when I was in conversion therapy, I believed that the treatment was working at times. I believed it would work. I thought I was going to end or walk out of conversion therapy as a straight man. I actually gave it my all. And we hear that from a lot of people. If I was maybe 18 or 19, you know, maybe I can entertain my parents for some time until I made some of my own money or went off to school or figured out some scenario where I can be on my own. And so being that young had an impact on me. It had an impact on others as well. And so as year after year went on of me being in conversion therapy, I knew that I was not changing. If anything, my attraction for men only got stronger, maybe slightly deprivation, but more so I was going through puberty and I was becoming a man, and what I was attracted to, it was clear. And in my last 2 years of conversion therapy, age 20 and 21, I felt confident enough to challenge the therapists who were treating me, ask them questions. I saw four total, and three out of the four, you know, told me that they were ex-gay, that they had cured themselves. And I began to challenge them and ask questions, and they all, they got stumped. They didn't have an answer. They all, let me put it this way. I wanted to meet successful individuals. I wanted to meet men who had become straight. And so in my request, they did introduce me to other men who went through conversion therapy, married women, had kids, and I would have a one-on-one conversation, and they all admitted that their attraction has not gone away. And they have learned to live with it and have a so-called heterosexual life. And that was probably the biggest reveal to me the whole time, because that's not how conversion therapists describe their work when they're getting new clients.
Right.
And it was the first time where I was like, wait a second, then this actually doesn't work, and I'm going to have to live with this. And that was the whole, like, everything began to crumble down, crumbling down about the validity of this working. Even my own therapist admitted to having same-sex attraction, the one who's supposed to be curing me. And some of them remarried, some of them didn't. And their lives, you know, as I was older enough to see it, their lives were not really put together the way they described. They were not taking their own medicine, so to speak. And that gave me a lot of confidence to walk away. I didn't come out immediately. It took time. It took me another 2 to 3 years. Oh, 2 years. Like, I left conversion therapy at 21. I came out of the closet again at 23. And that year was, you know, I was, you know, I went through so many layers of undoing what I went through in conversion therapy. I came out of the closet really reluctantly. I thought I failed. I thought I was, I failed and I lost and I'm giving in to the now gay lifestyle and I had to figure this out. And going to see therapists and understanding my first experience with a psychotherapist, I had no idea what a therapist actually does. And trusting them and trusting my employer. I had a gay employer living in New York at one point. And, I just got discovered a whole new world that was not available to me. And that same year, just right when I turned 24, I made a YouTube video for the It Gets Better project where I talked about bullying, but specifically in regards to conversion therapy, if someone's trying to make you change, it was about the It Gets Better project, stick it out and it does get better.
Right.
And that
right.
video ended up in the evening news in New York and on many web channels. To my surprise, I had never had a YouTube account. And that changed everything. I ran home that night. I got a lot of phone calls and emails from different people who knew me, who saw the articles. And it was only like a 4-minute video. And I went home and my face was plastered on the cover page for Huffington Post about, that my video made its way around the blogosphere world. And it was really the comments that blew me away. The comment section became like almost like a forum where people were sharing their conversion therapy stories. And I had never been exposed to anything like that. And in the real moment of realizing I'm not alone in this. And so there was
right.
with that in those weeks ahead, several organizations had reached out to me. And one in particular was the National Center for Lesbian Rights. And they were just in that moment had passed California. They had me hop on board to support them. And for the next 2 years, we started working on legislation. And then together we created Born Perfect as its own campaign, which I'm a co-founder of. And I oversee the Born Perfect campaign. But really NCLR, they were the people who got behind me to support this movement and get it going. And it was their legal team that was behind it.
Wow, that's amazing. And you have racked up, to your point, enormous success in the interim, being part of that. I mean, it has been mind-blowing how quickly this has moved compared to other things that have been worked on by the community. What do you remember as being kind of your greatest feeling of success as part of Born Perfect?
Oh, wow. There's been so many it's a good question. Specific to Born Perfect, I think it was the moment that Barack Obama announced his support publicly, and the White House Julia Barrett, that White House correspondent, who asked all of us that they would want to, the White House as an organization wanted to make its own video on conversion therapy and the support to end it. And I was actually at a birthday party, and I didn't know, I knew he was contemplating, making a public statement, and I got like a New York Times notification. This is 2015, about Barack Obama, and I was in tears at this birthday party. I get the chills just even thinking about it. because by 2015, everyone in my personal community, my friends and family, had known how the work I was putting in, and people were just screenshotting and like, oh my God. And I almost like in a panic, you know, got on the phone with the lawyers that we're working with, and from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. the following day, it was news interview after news interview after news interview to talk about what Barack Obama's statement meant, what was to come next, how, you know, and it was mind-blowing. So not just, like, is it great to have a president acknowledge an issue that's so near and dear, but if I look back at being alone, I was in Convergent Therapy for years. It was such an enormous secret of mine, because I'm trying to become straight. I wasn't telling people, couldn't tell anyone what I was going through. And even when I came out as a gay man, I wasn't really, it was not something I was proud of. I didn't really share with other gay men or other LGBT people I became friends with that I went through this horrific experience. And to see the president of our country make such a statement in support for all those people who are suffering in such a way that people, the general public may not know, is profound. And it was, I think that was what was so enormous, the contrast of where I was and where I am in that moment.
That's amazing. That's astounding. It was astounding he did it, but it was astounding that you got to be there front and center for it. Brody, you have any questions?
Well, this is an issue that I have been involved with as a journalist since about 2007, 2008. I am friends with Wayne Besson, who's the executive director of Truth Wins Out. Early on, we were targeting an organization that was founded in California in the early 90s, known as the National Association for Research and Therapy of Homosexuality, which is basically the kingpin organization at the time for anti-gay promotion of the pseudoscience. It was founded by Joseph Nicolosi, Charles Socrates, and Benjamin Kaufman. All three of them were licensed psychiatrists or psychoanalysts. And in 2006, the American Psychological Association had stated that there is simply no sufficiently scientific sound evidence that sexual orientation can be changed. And they targeted NARS in particular. NARS itself was later found to be and labeled a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. There was a case in Jersey, Ferguson versus Jonah. Jonah is an acronym. It stands for Jews Offering New Alternatives to Homosexuality. And that case actually led to the state of New Jersey finally outlawing the practice. And overall, it's always been pseudoscience. It's always been problematic. And as Matt pointed out, it's partially driven by the religious right, and partially by people that believe it in terms of pseudoscience. And again, this is a thing that, you know, nowadays we're confronting because of, you know, folks tackling the trans community and trying to use the similar type tactics and similar phraseology in terms of transition and gender identity for the trans community. Recently, we've got three local jurisdictions that have clamped down hard. In February, Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, passed an ordinance banning it. Covington, Kentucky in March, and most recently at the beginning of this month, Tallahassee, Florida. So there is groundwork being laid, and as Matt pointed out, we do have 20 states that, you know, have actually banned the practice. But I think the thing that really is important that we need to continue to get the messaging out there and to get people to understand that, you know, regardless of what their religious beliefs may or may not be or what they may or may not know, there's absolutely no scientific grounding at all whatsoever for this practice. This practice is, in fact, harmful, and this practice does, in fact, lead to especially LGBTQ adolescents, and that's folks between the ages of 14 and 24, to kill themselves, commit suicide. And particularly now, it's problematic because of the COVID-19 crisis, because we have a lot of LGBTQI youths who are now at home, out of their schools. They're away from their affirming safe spaces. They may be in a home where conversion therapy is being talked about. The Trevor Project told me and a few others in the press that at this point they have nearly doubled their telephone traffic on their, you know, crisis lines with, you know, the kids with depression and anxiety and things like that. Matt and I had actually conversed about this off the air. So I don't really have a question. I just kind of have a generalized statement about, you know, what it looks like and what we are looking at.
I was wondering if what the question was that you were leading up to, but in case I do have a question, Matt, with what Brody was just describing, what would your message be to teens that are either being forced in that kind of therapy now, they're away from any kind of other distractive peer group with school, et cetera. One of the things I think I'm going to theorize that some of them have even found our podcast because they can listen to it in private and get information on their own. So what would your message be to somebody who is not able to connect with others but going through that kind of program right now themselves?
Yeah, I think the one thing, if I were to tell any kid, you know, directly, is not to doubt themselves, you know, that what they're, that who they are is true and real, you know, if they're gay, lesbian, trans, or queer, and that, you know, who their identity is real, not to doubt it, you know, when you're so young, because of the negative responses, we doubt what we're actually experiencing and what we know to be true. So I would really want any child or any kid or teenager to know to hold on to that. It's sacred. It's a part of who you are, and you don't want anyone to really take that away from you. If you have access to the internet, that's important. There are so many ways to get support. One of it is just finding friends or commonalities and people you can connect with. You know, we're all, you know, many teenagers are stuck at home and may not have an outlet, and the internet is a great way to stay connected. Statistically, LGBT people, and this is before the coronavirus, but we're online more than relatively to heterosexual people because we may come from communities where we don't have any outlet. So the internet actually has been an incredible source to connect. One, you can go to bornperfect.org and connect with us and follow the work and see what's happening. The Trevor Project is a great resource, specifically if you are in a crisis where suicide ideation is something that is being considered. And then legally, I would go to the National Center for Lesbian Rights helpline if you actually are in a situation where you're maybe being forced into conversion therapy, or or some other circumstance with your guardians. The lawyers at the National Center for Lesbian Rights will support you legally if there's a case that they believe that they can help you in a situation they can get you out of.
That's excellent. I wanted to ask you, the therapy that you were forced through, does not sound like it had a huge religious component. Is that the case, or did we just not touch on it?
There was religion at times. I really, to my request, and this is me being like a, I don't know if it's a smart ass or whatnot, but me doing my due diligence, I really wanted to experience the change. I knew how I felt around boys, and I said, great, I want to know that I will feel that same attraction for a female. And, you know, I grew up in a conservative community, but I didn't want someone to just tell me to pray and then I'll get better. And so I was looking for the hard evidence throughout that's personal to my experience. And so, but yeah, religion is a huge factor, and it depends on the therapist. You know, I come from a Jewish home, but I also had therapists who had a Mormon background or a Christian background or a more evangelical background. And during those 5 years, most of it was one-on-one therapy. I did also attend one camp, which is Journey into Manhood, which is a conversion therapy program that's still run today throughout the country and Europe. The Jonah trial that Brody just mentioned were some of those boys I knew personally from my camp experience in Journey into Manhood. And so, yeah, it's, you know, conversion therapy, I'll put it this way, regardless of what religious background, whether Jewish or evangelical or otherwise, they're all working together. And it's a network and it's an industry in the United States. Where there's money being made when it's referrals from one to another, whether it's coming from a pastor or from a licensed professional. And that's what we're trying to break down and take apart.
Well, yeah. And how many of the cases that you've been involved with in the different states has the question of religious freedom been the point of the other side, and how has that been overcome in court?
So from our opposition, so for example, like at the hearing, that issue comes up every time. As a track record, with the 20 states have passed, yes, it comes up every time. Out of the 20 states, we've had 5 federal lawsuits where those states have been challenged. We currently have, but we've won every single time. We have one still ongoing for the state of Maryland. We had won the case in Maryland, and it is now in appeals. We have had a few city ordinances that are being challenged. We've only had one ordinance be struck down, and that was the city of Tampa. And we struck that down. It was struck down in court on the basis that the judge said, I don't think cities should be doing it, leave it to the states. Which we're happy with that because, you know, the goal of the conservative right of this country, I don't know why that sounded funny, but there is an opening to expand religious freedom and religion, freedom of speech. And so, this is a broader perspective, but basically, as the Trump administration and President Trump himself has appointed more conservative federal judges throughout the country, the landscape is changing. And so we have an incredible winning streak of lawsuits on the federal level and on the local level. But as judges begin to change, we are worried of the potential, or maybe we're not pessimistic, but we're preparing for the worst. And what that means is, we believe that there will be a Supreme Court case in the coming or in the near future regarding conversion therapy. And I guess another example I can make, this is getting into the weeds with legal stuff, but we passed a New York City ordinance, a New York City law banning conversion therapy, and we actually repealed it. And this was our learning process. It was the only law out of the, you know, 70-some-odd cities and 20 states where we, instead of just banning it for minors, we actually banned it on the basis of consumer fraud. And as even though we believe conversion therapy is consumer fraud and we've won conversion therapy lawsuits, like the Jonah trial was on the basis of consumer fraud, it doesn't work. Consumer fraud does not work as well as a law versus as it would be seen in a civil case. And so we actually repealed the New York City law the moment we had the New York State law go into effect. And so what we recommend, you know, at conferences and legal organizations and law firms across the country, if you want to start a lawsuit where a former patient is suing a therapist on the basis of consumer fraud, we encourage that. And for elected officials, we're saying if you're interested in passing a law, that you don't put it on the basis of consumer fraud, but you're banning it for minors because they are the ones who are most at risk, and that is the safest way we keep those laws intact.
Right. No, excellent work. And thank you so much for sharing that with us. We're starting to wind down our time here. What should we have asked you that we have not talked about yet?
We covered a lot. I don't know. I think, you know, because of the pandemic, and I did cover how individuals can reach out and different resources. But if there's, I don't know, I think I just want to say that if there's availability, if you're stuck at home with family members, and this is a time that you can connect and grow with those family members, great. And if you're in a position where you, and I encourage that, and if you're in a position where you cannot, look for other resources online. And sometimes it doesn't have to be a resource. Better yet, a friend or a relative. It's that one relative, that one friend you can speak to and connect with and check in with. Those are the, in my opinion, really the life-saving relationships that make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just really want people to know that you, many of us don't may not realize, but we always have that one person we can really go to, and not to forget that.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much for everything you do. You are a hero, and I can't even begin to tell you the appreciation I feel for your work and what you're accomplishing. You know, 20 states down, 30 to go. We're definitely here for you, and can't wait to see the end of the road on this, where this will forever become a thing of the past. Brody, any final words from you?
I think it's important that, you know, people understand that this is still very much an ongoing issue. It's an issue that desperately needs to be addressed, particularly in jurisdictions where it is still unfortunately allowed to operate. Matthew, if you tell the readers again how they can find your organization, and also for those that you want, it's the National Center for Lesbian Rights, NCLR, in San Francisco. They have a website too, but Matt, if you could give you ours, Born Perfect, please.
Yeah, you can check us out at, or visit our site at bornperfect.org. We are also Born Perfect on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
Excellent. Well, thank you, like I said, so much for joining us. Brody, thank you for everything you do. And I want to thank our listeners. We appreciate you very, very much. Please spread the word about us. We are available on any of the podcast apps. Just do a search for Rated LGBT Radio and hit subscribe. We love our growing audience. Also, on Saturday nights, please also tune in to our other show, Out in Santa Cruz. You can listen to that on www.ksco.com. That's a live show, 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time. Although on the KSCO website, there are past episodes there as well. That's a little more culture-oriented and breaking news of the day there. But we will be back here again next week on Rated LGBT Radio, bringing you yet another very important interview. We don't know what it is yet, but we know that it will be important. Again, thank you so much, Matthew, for being with us today. And as for our listeners, we will talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.